want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My humble thanks to the subscribers who support this program, like David Krebs, Wayne Bishop, Kathleen Emmer, and Gary Washington. All the details, including our bonus book offer, on the homepage at peterbcollins.com.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend.
Oh, yeah.
Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
I can dig it.
Smiling.
In our second segment of today's podcast, longtime journalist Rory O'Connor joins us to talk about his new book about Facebook and other social network sites called Friends, Followers, and the Future. When somebody pokes you on Facebook, think of them as one of those smiling faces. But first, an update on the effort to overturn Citizens United by getting the Supreme Court to decline to accept the appeal from Montana of the Supreme Court decision from that state, which upheld a law that conflicts with Citizens United. It was an initiative adopted by voters 100 years ago, saying that corporations can't play in political campaigns in the Big Sky State. And we continue to watch SCOTUS blog and other sources for any indication from the Supreme Court about when we will learn their decision regarding this case. Attorney Carl Mayer returns, along with activist Adam Fergatch. Gentlemen, good to talk to you on this Monday.
Thank you, Peter B. Thanks for having us on.
You bet.
Hi, Peter. I'm glad we get to continue this conversation, as the court has not yet ruled. We thought that they might have a decision today, Monday, but they have not made their decision yet, so we have a few more days to continue the conversation, to educate people as to what they may be able to do to help the cause here.
All right, and Carl, can you brief us on the procedures at the Supreme Court? This coming Thursday, the 21st, is the final conference of this term. So if the justices decide to dispose of this case in one way or another, it will come through Thursday's conference, which would likely be announced a week from today on the 25th. Is that about right?
Yes, that's correct. It's the final conference coming up this Thursday, and that means that it would be the final opportunity this term for the judges to decide on whether to accept the petition of the business interests to have the Supreme Court overturned the terrific decision of the Montana Supreme Court, which held that corporations cannot contribute directly to political campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court doesn't have to take it up this term. They could still postpone it until the fall, although that seems unlikely. But then again, all of the so-called Washington experts, insiders, Supreme Court watchers, pundits, etc., they were all predicting that today the court would announce that they had summarily reversed the Supreme Court of Montana, mm-hmm. and that Citizens United extended to all the state, not just to the federal election. So already conventional wisdom has been turned on its head. We can only hope, but we think it's certainly possible that maybe the reason is this nifty little jurisdictional argument that Adam Fergatch, Rob Hager, and myself have been raising in our briefs. And that argument is that the Supreme Court cannot hear Montana's case on states' rights grounds, on 11th Amendment grounds, that the Supreme Court has to have its hands off of Montana's election law.
Mm-hmm.
So we have we've been given a reprieve because we have more time to convince the court and to convince the Montana Attorney General to boldly state that the Supreme Court should not accept this petition because it doesn't have jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have another 72 hours to drive a stake in the heart of Citizens United, and that's why we're here.
And I think that Adam Liptak of the New York Times, the Supreme Court beat reporter, who predicted that there's no mystery here, that this will be summarily dismissed, he has been consulting astrologers, I understand, over the last 48 hours to try to sharpen his forecast.
Yeah, his crystal ball was a little cloudy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, we'll send some Windex over there. Now, Carl, as a practical matter, is there really any prospect that Steve Bullock, the Attorney General of Montana, is going to suddenly start listening to you when he's made it pretty clear that his hearing aid is turned off? And there was an op-ed in Friday's L.A. Times that pretty well defines his motives here. He's a grandstander. He wants to be able to try this case before the Supreme Court. His dream date would be sometime in the second week of October, because in the on the second Tuesday of November, he is standing for election as governor of Montana. And wouldn't it be ideal for him to be able to argue this case just like a Tommy Lee Jones character and have no outcome? He's advocated for the people of Montana, and whatever the decision is will fall after he has won or lost the governorship. And so it's just a perfect campaign tool for him.
Well, that's the whole problem, but I think people in Montana and around the country are waking up to this. They know that the citizens now know that they don't want grandstanding. They don't want the Montana Attorney General just to go up to the Supreme Court and argue so that he can bloviate about how much he's doing for the people, when in fact the best way to put a stake in the heart of Citizens United is to get the Supreme Court to reject the case to begin with, right now. Right here, right now, as Adam Fergatch likes to say. And I remember we just recently prevailed in this the case in which we represented Chris Hedges in a lawsuit that we won an injunction to stop the NDAA, the Homeland Battlefield Building. And before that case, the conventional wisdom was that we would never win. We didn't have an argument. No one wanted to touch the case. They thought we were whistling in the dark. And I think that's the same thing that's going on here. Rob Hager and Adam Fergatch, they've been on the front lines of making this very crafty 11th Amendment argument. And I think Adam can tell us how to get in touch, because I don't have the number. I think Adam does, how to get in touch with the Montana Attorney General in the last 72 hours here, because we have 72 hours left.
Go ahead, Adam. I have the numbers if you need briefing.
Well, I wish I didn't have him always at hand, that he would just kind of step up and do the right thing. I'll give the numbers first, and then I'll have a comment about that.
Sure.
So Attorney General Bullock's office is area code 406-444-2026. That's area code 406-444-2026. And when you call, it's hard, to get through. The people who answer the phone, they are actually giving some misinformation. We've had people call, and they are saying the party line, that they don't want, that basically they don't want the case to be thrown out right here and now. They want a chance to go and argue it in front of the Supreme Court. So people just be firm and polite and say that we want Attorney General Bullock to file a simple one-page motion that team, that's the 11th Amendment Movement, that's our group, the 11th Amendment Movement, or team, as far as a one-page 11th Amendment argument to raise jurisdiction with the court. It's very simple. They can do it in an hour, and he still has time to do that. So that's what we would like, you know, people to do. I would also suggest, I won't give out any of the phone numbers. We've been reaching out to the press there in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
I did a radio interview on one of the talk radio stations right there in Helena, the capital, and that went well. However, that was a couple weeks ago, and no one there seems to be willing to touch this angle of the story based on the reports that came out last week that clearly show that there may be this political grandstanding motive for Attorney General Bullock until he says definitively one way or the other. I actually am more prone to give him the benefit of the doubt. That's kind of the person I am, and I think that's the kind of that we all would like to be, to, you know, until somebody declares themselves, well, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But the longer it goes on without him making a comment, it's hard to come to another conclusion since these reports have come out. So to people can take it on their own. Just go, there is a site, if they do a search engine for Montana newspapers and radios, there's a couple sites that will give a whole list of all the newspapers, and call them up, ask for their news department, and say, hey, have you covered this 11th Amendment story and why Attorney General Bullock is not raising the argument, and he might, you know, be risking the whole thing. So, you know, all little outreaches, little tendrils of information might all coalesce to actually get him to do the right thing. This week, we got a few more days, so let's hope.
All right. And the phone number in the Attorney General's office is 406-444-2026. That's 406-444-2026. And when he's not fly fishing, Governor Schweitzer can be reached at 406-444-3111. 444-3111. And what was your reaction, Adam, to Mr. Bullock's op-ed in last Friday's L.A. Times? He had a good opener. He said, you know, when you look at a NASCAR race, they've got the corporate logos all over the cars, all over the drivers and their helmets, and there's no mystery about who's paying for the NASCAR race. And he said he wishes that in politics, you know, we could identify who's paying for the candidates in a similar way. So that part was pretty clever. But he insists, and I consider it folly, that he wants to fight this case before the Supreme Court because he thinks he can persuade the exact same five justices who approved Citizens United just over 2 years ago to renounce it because they've seen the evidence of all this money in campaigns and it will turn their noses. That seems pretty far-fetched, doesn't it, Adam?
It's an argument. Look, I'm not the attorney here, so Carl may have to address this more specifically. However, there's a huge hurdle to overcome before getting to the point of being able to argue in the Supreme Court in 6 months' time or however long it is, and that hurdle is that the court has this available option to do what's called a summary reversal behind closed doors. That's what they had a conference on last Thursday to meet. They could have announced it today. They did not, as Carl described. They will have another conference this Thursday where they will discuss this option of summary reversal, where the five justices who voted for Citizens United could say, hey, we're not going to revisit any of this. We're not going to be dragged through the muck in the papers and in a hearing and everybody criticizing us about whether we did the right thing 2 years ago. We know we did. We don't have to go through this whole political brouhaha. We just vote right now. We reverse Montana's court. That's it. The end of it. No comment. They don't have to say anything. It's behind closed doors. And that's the end of it. So that's the hurdle that that Attorney General Bullock is risking before it ever gets to a chance for him to argue in front of the court.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Montana's own brief that they put in to try and stop this thing, they said, well, we don't want you to accept this case. And they gave, in our opinion, a very weak argument. It raised no new issues. It was the same old, you know, corruption, money corrupts, and all that. Well, the court already ruled on that. there's no new issue. So that would not really be an issue that would get them to deny the petition. So the argument they made was not very good. He has to overcome the hurdle and to put the whole case at risk for that seeming grandstanding is just, it doesn't seem right. I understand it. Look, Carl may attest, it's every attorney's dream to argue a case before the Supreme Court. I don't doubt that every attorney, including Attorney General Bogle, would like to do that, but we're saying this is not the one to achieve that particular dream on, because he can gain just as much political goodness out of winning the case right now. The whole country will applaud him. So yeah, that's our position.
All right. Carl, your comment?
Yeah, it's just a little strange that the Attorney General Bullock keeps insisting that he's rolling up his sleeves. He keeps using the phrase, he's really rolling up his sleeves and taking a personal interest in this case, but yet he won't explain why he won't make a simple jurisdictional argument, which is usually the first one that lawyers make. We were always taught, every lawyer is taught in law school, that if you have procedure on your side and the other side has the facts, the side that has procedure will win 99 times out of 100. So it's always the first thing that a lawyer does is tries to defend a case by arguing that the court doesn't have the jurisdiction to sit in that case. And here, there's a very well-founded states' rights argument that the court has to leave Montana's election system alone. And if Attorney General Bullock has his sleeves rolled up, I don't understand why he's not explaining why he wouldn't raise that argument. I don't think it's too late. I think we have now we have an extra 3 or 4 days to go. And to the extent that people can call and write an email, I hope that he'll change his position and realize that he stands, that he does stand to be a national hero if he gets this case dismissed without the court hearing it right now, rather than going up and arguing what's been argued ad infinitum before the court and lose. That wouldn't serve anyone's interest, mm-hmm. To have him go up and lose this. And unfortunately, I think we could have, you know, in the old days, they used to write what are called Brandeis briefs, and those are long briefs that explain the facts of a case rather than, they concentrate on the facts rather than the law. And there were a lot of Brandeis briefs put in this Montana case explaining how money has corrupted politics. But the five person majority, the conservative majority, they've rejected that argument time after time. They just don't see it. They don't believe that money corrupts politics. And it doesn't matter. You could pile Brandeis briefs from here up to the moon, and they still wouldn't be persuaded. They don't think that's how politics works.
And Carl, here's the closing line from Bullock's op-ed in the L.A. Times. He says, if the Supreme Court takes Montana's case, I hope it will be the vehicle for the court to reconsider its Citizens United decision and return sanity and transparency to all elections in this country. Now, right there, by invoking sanity, I think he excludes himself from being a rational player before the conservative wing of this court. Who is he kidding?
Yeah, the court has already, they've invested enormous amount of intellectual energy in upholding two incredible fictions, fairy tales, that corporations are persons and that money is speech. And so they don't live on the same planet as people who actually are involved in elections and understand elections. They live on some other planet. And the notion that Bullock is going to come in as an earthling and talk to the Martians on that issue, just not going to happen. You have to talk Martian. And the Martians talk about states' rights, and that's the argument. And that's the argument that Firgash, Hager, and Mayer have been advanced in their amicus briefs, and it's now time for Montana to carry that ball, because it's just persuading these guys, persuading these guys that money corrupts elections. We might as well, might as well talk to the Flat Earth Society and tell them that the Earth is round.
Adam,
not going to happen.
Adam, have you been taking a language course in Martian?
Translated, that means we still hope that Attorney General Bullock will do the right thing for Montana. Well, look, as I said before, everybody has their own motives and drives, and we don't know exactly what Attorney General Bullock's might be. It would be understandable. He wants to do it in the Supreme Court, but realistically, to put the whole case at risk for that when the other option is available, looking deeper, I mean, I almost hate to say it, but there might be other motives that haven't even yet been brought forward as to why this basic jurisdictional argument isn't being made. It's illogical. It's illogical. So there are sometimes there are explanations that prove the logic behind it, but only with some information that we are not yet getting.
Mm-hmm.
So in time, that will come out. No matter what the court decides, the 11th Amendment movement will have other ways to bring forward 11th Amendment. Montana has another district court case, a federal court. Again, the same 11th Amendment. A private party, a corporation, cannot sue a sovereign state in a federal court except in very limited circumstances, and those circumstances are not applicable here. So he can still bring it in the other case. Eventually the story will get out. But we really do hold. Look, the court here is, whatever people think, they see the arguments. They have seen the briefs. They read all the briefs, or their clerks do. They know this argument. Now, the justices can still, on their own, decide to do the right thing. Now, and it only takes one of those five justices who voted for Citizens United who they've all voted for 11th Amendment rights in similar cases. So it only takes one to switch their vote and say, hey, the Constitution is paramount here. We're not admitting that I was wrong 2 years ago in Citizens United. I was still right. But in this case, we cannot hear the Montana case. So we deny the case, and that's it. So that's still a possibility. It's the elegant solution. The judges can save face. They can uphold the Constitution. The Citizens United will be effectively reversed. The people will be happy. Conservatives, what are they going to complain? They're going to say, hey, we're criticizing you because you upheld the Constitution. Well, I would love to have a conversation with Mitch McConnell about that one.
Well, have a couple of shots of bourbon first.
No, but it's not us against them. Right now it's in the hands of nine people who really matter, plus one. Bullock can still do something to really, really bring attention to the court, but they know about it, and we still are optimistic that the court will find their way to actually do the right thing in spite of what seems to be unfolding on the political end up there in Montana.
Now, I'm sure both you guys have placed advance orders with Amazon for Antonin Scalia's new book called Reading Law, The Interpretation of Legal Texts. And our friend Adam Liptak at the New York Times, in between calling Dionne Warwick's Psychic Friends Network, managed to pump out a kind of mini review of the book in the Times over the weekend. And at the very end of his article, he said that it comes with a disclaimer. Quote, the views expressed in this book are those of the authors as legal commentators. Nothing in this book prejudges any case that might come before the United States Supreme Court. Now, that, of course, is an invitation to ignore it, and I will. So, Carl, in the section of the book called Words Must Be Given the Meaning They Had When the Text Was Adopted, there is a quote lifted here from the Scalia book that, quote, the word person includes corporations and other entities, but not the sovereign. Now, that plays in two different ways. One is the whole issue of corporate personhood that you've been focusing on since the early 1990s, and we've talked about at some length in this podcast series. But the other relates to the file name on the appeal from Montana and the substitution of the person in the form of Mr. Bullock for his title, which is Attorney General. So do you care to offer any speculation here about how Mr. Scalia will view the term person as it applies to the 11th Amendment claim, which, to recap for people, says that a private party, including a corporation, cannot sue a state or that that cannot be appealed to the Supreme Court. So you want to weigh in on this, Carl?
Yeah, the entire premise of conservative jurisprudence is that there has to be a strict construction of language, which is why it's so hypocritical for conservative jurists like Scalia to not precisely construe language when it comes to the rights of corporations. There's nothing. The word corporation does not appear in the Constitution, for example, not once. Even though the founders knew about corporations, because some of them, for example, Washington was on the board of directors of an early corporation, ran a corporation, but they knew about them, but they chose not to insert them in the Constitution to give them rights that people have. So it's contradictory for conservatives like Scalia to say you have to precisely construe language, and then for them to engage in the fiction that corporations are persons when the language doesn't admit that. But more directly to the Montana case, if Scalia is true to his principles, if it's true to the book that he has just written, if he's true to states' rights and conservative jurisprudence, he will note that the business interests in this Montana case made a fundamental pleading error, which is they named the Attorney General of Montana, they named the state of Montana rather than the Attorney General in his personal capacity in their papers. And that language error means that under 11th Amendment doctrine, you can't properly bring Montana into a federal lawsuit. And that's what the business interests are trying to do. Mm-hmm. So Scalia should, on that conservative principle that he himself has written about, vote to not accept the petition to hear the Montana case, meaning that Montana's terrific election laws, which exclude corporate contributions, would be upheld.
Adam, do you want to weigh in?
Carl, let me ask you about that corporation that George Washington didn't he have a line of axes specifically for cutting down cherry trees? I think wasn't that the product he was selling?
Well, I think that's mythology, Adam. He ran a company that built a canal. At that time, it was actually the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, which still is the one that departs from Washington and goes all the way out to Ohio. But at that time, corporations were very limited in what they could do.
I thought he was actually making moonshine at Mount Vernon.
that was a song. They wrote a song, Moonshine Over Mount Vernon. No. Anyway.
He's going to get his guitar out.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's turning into the Peter B. Collins Variety Hour here. Right?
Moonshine, music, whatever it takes to get Bullock to take 1 minute to sign a motion that says the Supreme Court doesn't have jurisdiction, whatever we have to do, we'll do.
Now, let's take this opportunity to direct people to Adam's website, adamfurgatch.com, F-U-R-G-A-T-C-H, and there you can witness for yourself his performance of a song he wrote himself and performs in the flesh about money and politics in the Citizens United case. And, Adam, I'm wondering if we might be able to work Mr. Bullock over by threatening to make him watch that video and sing and sing along with it.
Well, I hope it's a little more entertaining than that. But it was a lot of fun to do. Just some inspiration. I strummed the guitar a bit and have written a few songs over the years. And I just had the inspiration, and it came out. The title of the song is Reverse Citizens United.
Yeah.
And it is on my website, adamfurgatch.com, along with some other things I'm involved with. But it was fun to do, and we put it together, and people can go and watch it. Hopefully they'll be entertained and maybe educated a little bit and pass it around, you know, tweet it, get it around. It was fun making, and hopefully people will enjoy it.
Yeah, it is fun. I enjoyed watching it. So in closing, guys, I want to ask you each to comment on something that I went into some depth with Rob Hager on in our last podcast last week. And it was quite an eye-opener for me, because in our discussions, I have repeatedly said that I have no opposition to those who want to try to amend the Constitution to correct the error of Citizens United. But Rob really opened my mind and my eyes by pointing out that this could be an 8 to 10 year process. For example, the Equal Rights Amendment still hasn't been passed, and that started in the early 1970s. So this is a process that is very unpredictable in terms of the length of it. And at the end of that, even if we got a constitutional amendment that was, we thought, perfect and bulletproof, in relation to money in politics and corporate money in particular, it would likely be challenged and head back to the Supreme Court. Now, we would have bought some time, and perhaps the composition of the court will have changed, and it could be a different outcome. But given the history and given the age of everybody but Justice Kennedy in that five-person conservative majority on Citizens United, 10 years from now, many of those same boneheads will still be there. Carl, can I get your comment first?
Yes, well, we don't mean to detract from the efforts of those who are working so hard to amend the Constitution. And in fact, I believe I was the first to suggest amending the Constitution to exclude corporations from the Bill of Rights back in the late 80s, but it is a tremendously long process. I think it's been since 1988 that I first suggested that. There are numerous groups working on this. It's to the credit of many cities and towns across the country. They have passed amendments, local amendments, calling for the stripping of corporate rights. But the constitutional amendment process is a long, long road to go. And for those who are walking it, we support them, but we also say, let's try to score an important early victory right now, and let's do it in the next days, maybe week, depending on what the court does.
Well, and just underscore the point, if you would, that at the end of that process, it's likely that any approved constitutional amendment would be subject to review by the Supreme Court.
Yes, and unless we get a new court, and who knows what the vagaries of the sitting justices will be, it still is a process that's vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Adam?
We already have a constitutional amendment that can do the job right here, right now, of reversing Citizens United. We don't need a new one. We have it right here. The 11th Amendment in this unique confluence of the state of Montana, their case, with the Citizens United case, it's all coming together in this situation. The 11th Amendment can stand right here, right now, to do the job and effectively reverse Citizens United. So people can stand up, urge Attorney General Bullock to raise the 11th Amendment issue. It's a constitutional amendment whose time has come, so to speak. It really, this may be the most important use ever of the oldest amendment after the Bill of Rights, the most important use of the 11th Amendment in United States history. It should be, can still be used right now to reverse Citizens United. So call Governor Bullock. People can go to our website. That's www.11thamendment.org. That's 11thamendment.org. Get more background and find out how the oldest amendment after the Bill of Rights is the one that is best right here, right now, to be used to defeat Citizens United.
And just one friendly correction. It was a slip of the tongue, but you promoted Mr. Bullock to governor there a minute ago. He's still a wannabe. He is the attorney general.
Thank you for correcting me. that is good. Well, because we had talked about that Governor Schweitzer also knows about 11th Amendment, and he's been silent too, but it really is Attorney General Bullock that has the card to play, this one-page motion that can do wonders to help the case with no legal downside. If we can only just put a little more effort in this week, we got a few more days by grace of the court here, and we'll keep pushing right until we hear one way or the other what the court decides.
That's Adam Fergatch along with Attorney Carl Mayer. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today, and we will keep updating this story until we have an outcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Trash.com.
Hey, I got a question. Are we friends on Facebook? Do you regularly post my podcasts and other information and pretend that you like it? Let's talk about the Facebook thing and other social media applications. Rory O'Connor returns to our program. His new book is called Friends, Followers, and the Future, and it includes the lengthy subtitle, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. Rory, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, it's always a pleasure. Great to be back.
And Rory is the author of Shock Jocks, Hate Speech and Talk Radio that came out way back there in, what, 07 and 08 in the paperback edition?
2008 it was, yes, just 4 short years ago.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate the work you did there to expose the carnival acts in our media who, you know, they claim they're entertainers as they participate in diabolical political activities on a regular basis.
Well, or at least as they make shit up and put it forth as fact.
Yeah. And I looked up Shock Jocks on Amazon, and it says that people who like Shock Jocks also bought the Shock Jock Christian Active Shaping Male Protection Device. They're only $6.99 this week.
Okay. I'm not even going to ask what a male protection device is.
It's a cup.
Okay, got it.
Well, Rory, the last time we spoke, you were doing a fellowship at Harvard, and I never actually asked you what you were up to there, but now I have it in my hands. It's a powerful book about social media. Facebook gets a lot of coverage here. But tell me what drew you into this subject matter. You are a bit of a visionary guy. I hope that doesn't saddle you with too much responsibility. But you and Danny Schechter ran MediaChannel.org, the Global Center, and you really have been able to pick out some of the trends over the past 15 or 20 years. So I'm eager to hear what you have to say.
Well, you know, like many journalists of my or our generation, Peter, you know, my initial motivation for working in the media was the result of my desire to do something about the problems of the world. But very soon, as I was working in the media, I came to realize that the media actually is one of the problems of the world. And so a lot of my efforts since then have, as you know, have been in media dissection and media reform and so on. And I came to the conclusion around the middle part, around 2005, 2006, two things. One, that this emerging social media that was just then being created, not just Facebook, but YouTube, Twitter, they were all coming out then, as you recall, that this really represented a sea change in the way that information was being processed for us. Secondly, however, was that we were all faced, for the first time in history, with really a flood, a tsunami of now unmediated, unvetted, and largely unverified information pouring over us. And so I started to come to the conclusion that finding trustworthy and reliable and credible news and information really was the central issue in media of all types, whether it's the old legacy traditional media that I say is being killed in my book, whether it's the new and emerging media. There are a lot of good things about these new media tools and technologies, but one of the bad things is that it's become increasingly difficult to find reliable and trustworthy news and information.
Yeah. The other aspect of this is the extent to which they're gathering information about us. As we surf the web, the cookies that they collect from our browsers really are, it's awesome and fascinating and scary all at the same time. Because the idea that they can aggregate information about me and my interests and then serve those interests is on the one hand very appealing. On the other hand, the fact that they know the kind of political information that I read just about every night on the web. On Facebook, they serve up Elizabeth Warren ads to me. I'm not in Massachusetts, but they have figured out that I'm a left-leaning, politically interested guy. And so I get a parade of Barack Obama ads. And as I mentioned, Elizabeth Warren. And to some extent, that's interesting. But it's also unnerving to know that they have these huge server farms that just scoop up massive amounts of data on you and me.
Well, you know, you're bringing up the flip side of the trust issue, and that's the other piece of it. And that's why I say that trust, I really think, is the key issue going forward. So what you're really talking about is, can we trust any of these media firms, whether it's the legacy media? And, you know, I'd like to talk in a minute about how Gallup polls have shown over the last 40 years that trust is dropping precipitously among all Americans in what the media is telling us. And then we have these new media companies, whether it's a Facebook or a Google, who, you know, are clearly violating our privacy and acting in a non-trustworthy, and many regulators increasingly are saying, in an antitrust manner. Now, both Google and Facebook have come under a lot of scrutiny from regulators, both in Europe and here in the United States, over these very privacy issues that you're talking about. So the good news is that it's finally becoming something that regulators and not just users or consumers such as you and me are expressing increasing concern about. The European regulators have basically said to Google, either change your ways in the next few weeks or we're going to change them for you. And, of course, Facebook, which you mentioned, had a lot of problems with the FCC and signed a settlement from a suit over privacy issues, wherein they promised not to do it again, and they agreed to independent audits for decades. However, apparently that has not put an end to their anti-privacy practices yet.
Yeah. Well, and as you chronicle in the book, and I've been on Facebook for 5 years now, and I'm still, I consider myself a novice, and I don't feel that I understand exactly who's seeing the things that I post. I don't know exactly who sees that I like something. There are a lot of things that are somewhat mysterious, and I'm probably paying more attention than the average user, Rory. But, you know, just in a broad sense, you and I, before we started recording, we're talking about how our telephone calls are intercepted by the NSA. We don't know exactly who's listening to them or where they're stored or what keyword we can utter that would cause a human to intervene and say, ooh, better check that conversation. But we know it's going on, and Americans are incredibly passive in the face of the massive surveillance, scrutiny, and collection of their data. And Facebook allows us to volunteer information, and law enforcement does use it. Is the FBI using it for their next wave of national security letters? Well, we know they're focusing on Facebook. And we saw the case of the party monsters from England, the two 20-somethings, who tweeted back and forth about their upcoming holiday in the U.S., and they were met at LAX by Homeland Security and put back on a flight to London because one of them said he wanted to party so hard that it would destroy America. So these are just some of the clues that we have.
Look, there's absolutely no doubt, and there's lots and lots of evidence that not just the NSA, but the CIA, for example, the Associated Press reported more than a year ago that they're what they call themselves are the CIA's quote-unquote ninja librarians. And it's actually known as the Open Source Center. It's a branch of the CIA that is looking at millions and billions of tweets on a daily basis, looking at all this social media all over the world, and then gathering up and trying to sort through all that noise and find out the information that they then put in a daily brief that goes directly to the President of the United States. So, yes, the government is doing this. Yes, business is doing it. The real issue is, I think, for a company like Facebook, is they clearly have the ability to make this a lot easier. They have the ability to make it so that we can understand and we can control the process. We can decide if we want to give up personal information, how much we want to give up, who we want to see it. Now, Mark Zuckerberg obviously is a very intelligent and foreseeing fellow when it comes to computer applications. He knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell me that if he didn't want to make it crystal clear, even to the most internet non-literate person in America, how to control their privacy settings, I'm quite sure that he could do it. For example, I have one very obvious suggestion. Make everything so that you have to choose it first. You supposedly have to opt in, right, as opposed to opting out. That alone would represent a sea change in how Facebook is dealing with their community over this issue of privacy. But they refuse to do it, for commercial reasons. So the question then arises, well, how much should we trust Facebook? And I would say, since they're not allowing us to have the control that we shouldn't trust them very far.
Well, and there are many facets to this, Rory. I did some research at one point about 2 years ago and discovered that Facebook has essentially a backdoor for law enforcement. And so if I brag about the car that I stole or the teenage girl that I took to bed or something like that, there is actually a process where Facebook charges a fee to, say, a prosecutor, a district attorney, who wants to collect information from my Facebook page. So it's a revenue center. I don't know if it's a particular profit center, but they do generate revenue from selling your information to law enforcement. And that's something that is public. It's available, but the average Facebook user doesn't appear to know diddly about it.
Yeah, but look, let's not just focus on Facebook, because a lot of companies are doing this. And for example, you know, I just wrote a piece on Wired.com that was headlined "Google is Evil," and I looked at Google's repeated practice of, you know, they're going throughout the world photographing the world's streets, as you know, for their mapping project, so-called Street View. But what we also found out is that they were gathering up internet data from everybody's wireless networks while they're doing this, including the content of all sorts of private communications, people's wireless passwords, emails, and so on and so forth. And when they were confronted with this, the Google executives first denied that it was happening.
Right.
Then they said it was a mistake. And then they said that it was the work of one rogue engineer
right.
who they employed, none of which was true. And last April, the Federal Communications Commission, which was investigating this, concluded that Google had, quote, deliberately impeded and delayed the inquiry into the data collection, and they fine Google for this.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, Google is going out there, is gathering up, literally gathering up, our private information without our consent, without asking it, storing the data, possibly holding on to it for some future use that we don't know about, and denying that it's even happening. So I just wanted to say that this is a very widespread problem in commerce, in government, and this is something we ought to get into in a few moments, increasingly in political campaigning. Because, you know, those same techniques of data mining that Facebook uses to figure out whether to serve you an Elizabeth Warren ad are now being employed by both the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign
yep.
to figure out how to target an online video ad that would be particular to you so that you and I will actually be targeted in different ways and see different ads. And this is a sea change from, of course, what has happened in the past with television advertising.
We will come back to that. Rory, let's stay with Google for a moment here because Google Plus is the social networking application that is supposed to be more privacy rich, or it guards my privacy and allows me to set up circles of people who I talk to. And for example, when I post on Facebook, if I put up something that is one of my hard left political views or one of the stories that I cover on my podcast, I'm always concerned about, well, my Republican neighbor's going to read this and it's going to piss her off, or, you know, the kinds of reactions, because I don't feel I have very much control on Facebook over who sees something once I post it. But Google Plus was offered as the new and improved social networking application, yet very few people have been drawn to it. And it appears that it's shaping up to be the next big blunder in the world of Google.
Well, look, here's the thing. Google is a search company in an increasingly social world. And that's a bad place for them to be. Now, they have been trying. They recognize, of course, that social media is increasingly becoming important. They've recognized it for more than a decade, and they've been trying to get into social media since 2002. They bought Friendster. They created their own early social network, Orkut, which was big in for a while in Brazil and India. They created the disastrous Google Buzz. And, of course, as you mentioned, they've now gone on and created Google Plus. The reason for all this is they understand the importance of social. The problem for Google is that it just may not be in their corporate DNA to do it well. And, you know, while we're talking about these privacy issues, let's not forget that it was only 2 years ago when they launched Google Buzz
mm-hmm.
that Google turned around and took all the emails, the private email list of everybody who was using Google email, and made it public overnight as they created the Google Buzz social network. Now, you know, I know people, such as one of my friends who consistently deals with political dissidents in Europe, and he had a lot of people on his private email list. He woke up one morning to find that that had been broadcast to the entire world without his knowledge and certainly without his consent. So,
mm-hmm.
again, there was a major breach of privacy with Google Buzz, and Google acknowledged that eventually and changed it. But the problem with all of these companies is that, you know, they tend to shoot first and ask questions later. They repeatedly change policies with insufficient consultation and communication with their community. Then they just overnight do something like Google did with Google Buzz, which can be very, you know, dangerous in the real world.
Yeah. Well, and Facebook had a similar application, right, where it would say Rory just went in and bought his wife a diamond ring at Tiffany's.
Right. Well, let's hope it was my wife and not my mistress. You know, you see where we're going here. You know, if I didn't choose to have the fact that I just bought that diamond ring for somebody made public, that could create some major problems in many individual lives.
Well, so, and what if your mistress finds out that you bought it for your wife?
Well, the point is, it's not so much privacy, it's control. If I choose to give up certain elements of my privacy on Facebook or to Google because I don't care, or in exchange for better services, or for whatever reason, fine. That's my choice. The issue is choice and control, not so much privacy. And what we're finding is that these companies like Facebook and Google and the others are not allowing us to control and not allowing us to choose.
And Mark Zuckerberg claims that privacy is passé, that our idea that you know, there's certain information that we get to keep about ourselves that is not shared with the general public. He seems to think that you and I are just old guards who got to get hip and used to the new system. But I would just offer this as a point, that after the blundered IPO, where Zuckerberg became a multi-billionaire, he got married. And there was a lot of speculation about whether she, the bride, had to sign a prenup to separate his wealth from hers. Now, I consider that to be private, and he's entitled to keep that information private, and so far he has. But, you know, in this Facebook world, shouldn't he be posting the prenup up there on Facebook for all to see?
Well, I think a better analogy would be for someone else to post it without his consent and without talking to him first.
There you go.
That's sort of the equivalent to what Mark has done. But, you know, it is true that he's now, you know, saying that the age of privacy is over. But, you know, earlier he claimed that privacy control was, and I quote, the vector around which Facebook operates. So, you know, Zuckerberg himself has gone through a 180-degree turn on this issue, from saying that privacy is the central organizing principle, if you will, of Facebook, to now saying that society has changed and we're moving away from privacy. Now, that may be true, it may not be true, but it does seem, frankly, a little self-interested for Zuckerberg to say that, because that, of course, is the basis for those billions that he has earned.
Yeah. And Rory, as a, you know, public figure, I've worked in the media for over 40 years now. On occasion, I have attracted people that I wasn't interested in, and they're called stalkers. And there was one woman who stalked me for over 5 years. She wrote over 1,000 letters to me. She somehow secured my home phone number toward the tail end of this. And it was very unnerving. She just wanted me to love her. I don't think she was going to hurt me. But the invasion of my privacy was something that was really unnerving. And it was unusual for me because, for the most part, I've been able to maintain adequate control over it. And when, you know, your private information and ways to reach you and personal information about, you know, what flavor of Ben and Jerry's ice cream you like, they collect that at the supermarket now. It's as if we really are all public people walking around in a virtual naked way.
Well, you know, and it is true that there are a number of people who do accept that. You know, I had a piece that I did for Wired.com just a few days ago about the Google privacy issues, and frankly, I was a little shocked at the number of commenters who equated being online and using the Internet to surrendering your privacy. They said, anyway, as soon as you go online, you should have no expectation of privacy. So clearly, as I was saying, that society is engaged in a debate over this issue. Some people say we don't need any privacy. Some people say we need it more than ever. I think we should have that debate. But my problem with the Facebooks and Googles and the large mega corporations is that they're not allowing a debate. They're making these unilateral decisions for us.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there it may well be that I want to give up some of my private information in exchange for these great new tools and technologies that are available for free and very empowering. It may be that I would give up even more of my privacy if, A, you asked me ahead of time, and, B, here's a revolutionary idea. What if somebody created a social network that asked me if I would share my information, and if I did, cut me a check and gave me a percentage of the money they're going to make off of it.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is something that I might choose to do. I might actually give up all my private information if it's a good enough deal. So this is what I'm saying, that we need to have this conversation, and we need to have more choice, and we need to have a lot more control over our own private information.
Now, Rory, recently I've been experimenting with Google AdWords to promote this podcast. And it's been very interesting because one of the episodes that I decided to promote was a conversation with Sybil Edmonds, the FBI whistleblower, and she and I do a podcast series together as well. So I wrote a Google ad, and it said, you know, like, FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds speaks, something like that. So a month later, I go into the analytics, and I got a huge number of hits on that particular line, but it turned out that 80% of them were people who were looking for Facebook because the first two letters of FBI are FB. And so then I talked to my very friendly young man, a Google AdWords counselor, who said, yeah, you know, you needed to put that FBI in quotation marks because the search picks up those first two letters and it just goes to Facebook.
Right.
So that proved to be very interesting to me. And the use of keywords that I embed in the code of the ad that I write enables me to attract people who are interested in stories about FBI whistleblowers, who are interested in the constitutional and legal issues that are raised by the exposure of official wrongdoing. But it's tricky to navigate, and my little anecdote there about FB and FBI is just one example of the early blunders that I've made trying to use Google AdWords. But the flip side of it is that in order to match up with a keyword that I choose, Google is vacuuming up information from every user to identify people who would match the keywords that I have used. And it's the collection of that data that concerns me and that makes me a little queasy even about using it to promote my podcast.
The collection of the data, the storage of the data, the potential future use of the data in products that haven't yet been invented. There are a lot of issues connected with this. You're absolutely right. And we're only talking on the commercial level. And if you take it up another notch to the political level, if you will, and you add that in, then we're getting into some grounds for some serious societal concern. But as I said, the good news is that the regulators, both here in the United States and in Europe, have finally woken up to this, and they're beginning at least to make some noise. Now, of course, it's also important to recognize that first Google and now Facebook have taken to spending millions of dollars and lots of time in Washington, D.C., having a political presence and lobbying right now because they understand the power that the regulators potentially have, and they're trying to neutralize that.
Well, remember, it was Jack Abramoff who chased Microsoft because Microsoft wasn't doing enough lobbying in Washington. So that, I think, kind of started the wave of tech companies buying influence, and Google and Facebook have been stepping up in recent years. Now, the other thing that I do, Rory, and my listeners are aware of this, I work as a media consultant on political campaigns for progressive candidates. And we just completed a primary campaign for an open seat here in for Congress here in California. and we used Google AdWords. And one of the techniques we use, and I don't think I'm pulling back a huge curtain for people here, is that some of the key words we entered were the names of our opponents. There were 12 people running for this open seat. And so I dutifully listed all 12 of those. And anytime somebody Googled an opponent, our ad would pop up either across the top margin or on the right-hand side. And it was interesting to see, in many ways, just when I would do searches, not intending to see my ad come up, but something that would include one of the keywords, and boom, there's a link to my candidate's website appearing on my search results page. Now, I don't consider that to be nefarious, but there are many clever ways that you can essentially use the power of the data collection to trick people into visiting your website. There are also dummy sites that are set up like, MittRomney.info, for example, could be a site of an anti-Romney campaign that is hoping that people will just enter the wrong extension or just be curious and enter that extension and end up at their website, or that they'll see it posted as a paid link and not notice the extension of .info and be tricked into believing it was actually Mitt Romney's website.
Well, yeah, again, then you say be tricked into believing. And so now we're coming back again to that central issue of trust and finding reliable and credible information. And one of the flip sides of the new tools and technologies, as you say, is that a tremendous amount of power has now devolved down. You know, these things used to be highly centralized and very expensive, and now, of course, they're democratized and they're cheap, which means that a lot of people can play around with them. And, you know, among those playing around with them, of course, are political campaigns. Some of what they're doing is perfectly kosher and on the up and up, but some of it is, I would say, verging on being anti-democratic, if you will. If you're trying to trick people, if you're trying to pretend to be someone or something that you're not, you know, I would say that that's a problem. Why don't you get out there and just try to give good, reliable, trustworthy information? And if you do that, you'll get a reputation for that over time, and people will come back to you. But spreading further disinformation, is a danger to a democracy. Look, we already live in a country where, you know, an astounding percentage of Republican voters, for example, not to single them out, but just as an example, still believe that President Obama is a Muslim who was born in Kenya.
Sure.
Okay, despite the fact that, you know, it's been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that those are factually inaccurate, and yet these things persist. So we have to question, well, why do they persist? And one of the reasons, as I said, is this ability to just continue to pour out more and more spurious information. Of course, the legacy media used to a much larger extent than they do now, you know, do some fact-checking and do some vetting of information before they would transmit it. What we find is that, you know, faced with their own crises and with the change to the digital form of media, that they're having such a hard time staying afloat that they, in many cases, are, you know, losing their old values. For example, the value of accuracy in journalism, obviously, you know, a crucial one.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, we're seeing that being replaced by just the value of speed, of being first, whether you're right or not. You know, a few weeks ago, an unknown blogger who was brand new, quoting anonymous sources, said that there was a federal investigation of Governor Haley in South Carolina and that she was going to be indicted soon. This was completely untrue, but nobody bothered to check it before they retweeted it and put it on their Facebooks. And when I say nobody, I'm talking, you know, major news outlets,
right.
Politico, the LA Times, you know. It was only hours later that someone actually had the good thought to call the governor's office for a comment, and that's when they found out that the story was completely untrue. So we have more and more of this happening, both in terms of the legacy media and on the emerging media. And one of the things I do in my book is, I'm trying to be positive in addition to outlining some of the problems. So How can we deal with this tsunami of unvetted and unverified information that's washing over all of us? And one of my main points is that we need to develop shortcuts or information filters that can help us along the way.
Yeah. Well, and one of Zuckerberg's arguments is that it's your friends who are the filters of the information that you view on Facebook. I guess I do get some very interesting information. We had a solar eclipse, and I thought that there were some really cool pictures that people posted on Facebook. On Father's Day yesterday, there were some really nice expressions of love for Dad, usually in the form of pictures. But so much of it is just useless, Rory. It's people who pick up graphics from somebody else's website, little cute bumper sticker type things, and post them. Somebody, I'm about to have breakfast with Rory O'Connor. Frankly, I don't consider that, information that everybody needs to know. And so Twitter for me is still a reach. I have a Twitter account. I pity the fools who follow me there because I don't tweet very often. But I have not really gotten a handle on Twitter. Do you tweet, and do you consider it useful?
I do tweet. I've actually was an early and enthusiastic adopter of Twitter almost from its inception. And I have an interview in my book with Biz Stone as one of the co-founders.
Yeah.
And I was talking with him, it was a few years ago, but the interview still holds up. But one of the things that I find as a practicing journalist is that Twitter actually is a great tool for journalism. It's where everybody I know now goes to find breaking news. It's a great way to develop stories and to develop leads. And, of course, there are some very interesting experiments going on within Twitter and using it as a form of journalism. I want to mention, for example, a fellow named Andy Carvin, who created the go-to place for everybody to go to get great information about the Arab Spring and what's been going on in Egypt and Libya and so on. And it was all being gathered at his Twitter account. So it has a lot of good uses. But I would say about all of these things that I really encourage people to get in to play with them initially, and I use that word deliberately, to experiment, to experience it, see what works for you, take the time if you can to learn the privacy controls so that if there are things you're seeing that you don't want to see, they can be eliminated, okay? It's not important to you that somebody's having breakfast. Then you can eliminate that from your feed. It's mm-hmm. not that hard to do if you take the time to learn. It should be easier. It should be intuitive, but it's not. You do have to work with it, work at it, and that's something that I think is unfortunate. But I am a big proponent of using the social media for the very reasons that you just pointed out. We all know from our own experience that the best referrals that we could ever get were from families and friends and so-called word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the 21st equivalent of that in Facebook, in Twitter, in Tumblr, and in many of the other new social media. And what we're doing is we're getting trusted referrals now via word of mouth, if you will. But it's the same process.
Yeah. I don't want to give short shrift to YouTube. They're now, the number three most visited site on the web?
Yes, and also the number two most used search engine mm-hmm. behind Google, which a lot of people don't know. So a lot of people use YouTube just to find out news and information.
Yeah. Well, I have to say my only concern about YouTube is when I go there, it's really hard to leave. I go to watch one video, and then they put all this eye candy out. Oh, check this out, and here's a funny one, and here's a serious one. And it's just like, wow, 3 hours later, you pull yourself away.
It really is incredible. I have a whole chapter in the book about YouTube, and it's called The YouTube Effect, 48 hours a minute. Now, when I wrote the book, amount of content that was being posted every minute to YouTube, 48 hours. Well, guess what? That's already obsolete. we're over 60 hours. Every minute there are 60 hours of stuff going on YouTube around the world. So this is why I talk about a tsunami of information. And what YouTube is grappling with is exactly that central issue that I identified, which is how can we separate the wheat from the chaff, the signal from the noise, in order to find, you know, useful and reliable information. Now, obviously, YouTube cannot and does not vet or verify the accuracy of the 60 hours that are being posted every minute. There's no way that they could. They actually rely on their community to flag things that might be inappropriate or untrue. So it's kind of a reverse way of doing things. Mm-hmm. But they are grappling with this issue, and that's what led them, quite recently, to create, along with outside entities, 100 new channels, because they're desperately trying to organize all that news and information in some useful way.
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. And finally, Rory, you don't mention LinkedIn in your book, and I'm relieved because it's the social network I choose not to participate in. I get those invitations all the time from people who already have my contact through email or some other manner. And I just don't have the bandwidth to adopt another service like that. And recently, they had a breach where usernames and passwords were hacked and revealed. And I'm not sure if that was an important security breach, because are there any transactions at LinkedIn or other activities that, for example, would reveal a credit card number?
No, not that I'm aware of. And, I'm fairly active on LinkedIn for a variety of reasons as well. I have, probably over 1,000 contacts on there.
Yeah.
The guy who created it, one of the creators of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, is a very, very smart guy. And I did interview him in the book on this more general topic of social networks and social media and where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really smart guy, and like me, he identified this issue of finding reliable information as being the most pressing one going forward. So, not to be too highfalutin about it, but we need reliable and useful news and information, whether we're a consumer and we want to go out and buy a product and we need to know, what's good and what's bad, or whether we're citizens and we need to go out and elect a president and we need to know who's good and who's bad. We need to have useful and credible information in the hands of our citizenry, or we literally can't have a fully functioning democracy. So this stuff matters on a lot of levels, and my message to people is that A, it matters, and B, it hasn't been decided yet. Where this is all going will depend on what, if any, actions people take today and going forward. So if you care about your privacy, if you care about the issues that we're talking about, if you care about having good information and having a good democracy, then you need to stand up and get involved and exert a little bit more control over these things, because, there is a positive message here. These new media tools and technologies are potentially incredibly democratizing and flattening out power if they're used right. If they're not used right, as we can see, they can be tools to perpetuate centralized power, both on a political, a governmental, and, of course, a corporate level.
Rory O'Connor, his new book is Friends, Followers, and the Future. It's out in softcover from City Lights Books. Rory, you got a website you want to drive people to?
I'd love people to go to roryoconnor.org. That's my Media is a Plural blog, and I continue to write about these issues there, on a daily and weekly basis.
Great to talk to you, Rory. Keep doing it, will you?
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Will you be my friend on Facebook? I sure hope so. Thanks for listening. Send me an email or a message on Facebook.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until